You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning at 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this. Very good morning to you. Welcome along to Monday morning's OTB AM. We're here with you all the way until 9:30 and maybe a little bit later because there's a lot to pack in to a very busy show after a very, very busy weekend. Looking forward to a pretty busy week in the world of sport as well. We'll talk about Liverpool and Everton, that nil-all draw. We'll hear from Seamus Coleman. We're also going to talk about the All-Ireland Camogie Finals in Croker yesterday. We're going to talk about the weekend's racing. We're going to talk about pretty much everything that happened over the course of the weekend, including, of course, the athletics last night, which was a triumph, a resurrection, really, for Kieran McGean and Mark English as well. Owen is recovering from his journey back up from Killarney.
Recovering from it? It is a long journey. Not going to lie about that. Does take... I guess it takes it out of you, just travelling that far across the country.
Yeah, but there's a crash after a high like that.
Yeah, I guess so. Like, you mean performance-wise? You mean a crash after any big sporting performance?
Yeah. Of course. Well, that's what I mean, Owen.
Well, yeah, I guess there has to be, doesn't there?
Well, you've witnessed the future, and it is this Kerry team. All the criticism of Peter Keane that you were the only one in the country who actually spotted when Colm O'Rourke had this kind of vaguely offhand mention of the young players coming through. You took them to task. You hammered them on social media for it. And you were right, Owen, in fairness. Week by week, minute by minute, imperceptibly, this Kerry team is now the kids of Peter Keane's. It's like, we need a Busby Babe style moniker for this team.
Yeah, until the inevitable happens, which is a Kerry versus Dublin league final in Croke Park and Dublin win healthily. Hell, like, that's going to just puncture not only my bubble, not only Kerry people's bubble, but everybody's bubble at this point. Because maybe the country actually need Kerry at this point, or maybe the country will actually derive some sort of pleasure from this Kerry team actually not living up to the heights, which is probably more closer to the fact.
No, everybody wants another team to be good.
Well,
a second good team in the competition would be a great thing.
I saw Kieran Cunningham tweeting a couple of weeks ago saying, the one thing we're forgetting about wishing Kerry to stop the five in a row is how insufferable Kerry fans will become. And is that the trade-off you want to have? Like, I can't speak here, obviously.
Well, you can.
I've kind of got a conflict of interest
here.
You know. Well, it wouldn't be insufferable. It would just be kind of like...
smoke self-satisfaction.
Exactly.
Which would be insufferable for the rest of us.
Like, sure, you know, it's only one All-Ireland. That's how it would be. It would just be kind of... Exactly. It would just be kind of a smug, sure, wasn't it nice while Dublin were around for a little while sort of attitude. And that would be fine too. But I'm sure most of the country don't want to see that happen. So I'm sure Kerry people are the only people who are getting any real pleasure from what's going on at the moment. Which is a slight encouraging sign.
But they were amazing, right? Not that they were amazing, but they managed to dig out a game against like a very seasoned... Monaghan team who had come to play and who knew exactly what they wanted to do.
Yeah, well, Conor McManus picked up a knock about a quarter of the way through the game, and as far as I could see, that really ended Monaghan's attacking flow pretty much straight away, because he was flying up until that point. O'Hanlon as well, in one of the corners, was playing really well at the start of the game too, and he seemed to fade out of the game a little bit. And once Kerry got to grips with those two players, it was kind of game over from Monaghan's perspective in terms of actually putting a dent into the scoreline. And once Kerry got up and running up front, then it was always going to be their game come the final quarter of the match. So a fully fit Conor McManus for the entire thing would have probably changed things, because Monaghan were pretty good for a while and Kerry were the second best team for the start of that game yesterday. So, like, again, you're looking into thing saying which parts of this team are actually going to be there come the summer and which parts are going to be relevant come the championship, because there's been so many false dawns from so many different counties over the past couple of years and you can't actually pine your hopes too much on them. The fact of the matter is, though, that
this isn't a false dawn. This is like the start of a new team. This is the start of a new management team who has the biggest collection of talent that any inter-county manager has ever been part of developing and also inherited.
Yeah, like there's definitely, I'm not sure if that's hyperbole or if you actually think that, but I think it's somewhere in the middle.
They've won five in a row All-Ireland minor titles.
Yeah, no, it's true.
So that's, whether or not you like it, that's not hyperbole.
Yeah, it's true. And they are, like the question was always around though, what would those kids become? Would those kids become senior ready? And there was legitimate questions last year. I would say there was plenty of people who were worried that maybe a lot of these guys actually wouldn't come through. And then all of a sudden over the past couple of weeks, a lot of those players have actually stepped up to the mark, namely Tomás O'Shea with his winning score and setting up the winning score as well against Galway and Tuam. And then yesterday, a guy called Graham O'Sullivan comes in off the bench and has a stormer for Kerry in the backs as well. So these are all these sort of players that were like, oh yeah, I remember watching him a couple of years ago playing for the minors. I thought he had faded out to the point where he actually doesn't live up to his potential. Actually, it just takes a little bit of time. And these guys, let's remember, were under 18 when we saw them first play in the first place. So let's actually give them 3 or 4 years. It's not kind of a 1 or 2 year later thing like David Clifford was.
Yeah, last year even younger as well. Okay, so we'll talk about that a little bit later on. David Brady's going to join us, talk to us about the Mayo-Galway game. Disappointment for Mayo ultimately at home, but you know, still early days. Let's not overreact to that. We can overreact to Kerry winning as amazingly as they did. And oh, we didn't even mention Sean O'Shea.
Yeah, well, that's just getting boring at this stage.
No,
he's boringly good at this stage.
No, come on. This is the type of stuff that like needs way more to be made out of it.
Yeah, if the All-Stars were handed out now, he's Player of the Year. But let's also remember that it is the month of March. Like, I would like to see players like him just get next weekend off. I think there's County League on down in Kerry next weekend, and I'm sure they're going to be let go back to their clubs. But this guy's played Sigerson, this guy's played every league game so far.
Give
a couple of the guys a break, is what I say. Like, if it was.
They're young, you know yourself, when you were that age, Owen, you can recover straight away.
Yeah, I know. It's a long time since I've been that age now. It's like been a full 2 years, I think, at this point, and the recovery was much better back then. Like, just in terms of, like, let's not get carried away with Mayo's performance on Saturday night just yet. Like, people who blame the conditions actually do have a point. And I was a massive advocate at the start of the year that Mayo were still up there in terms of being able to challenge Dublin. Like, my belief is being chipped away with every passing week at this point.
Mine isn't.
No?
No.
You think...
they're right there.
Everything that's up the sleeves is just staying up the sleeves.
I just think that, like, this isn't a team who needs to go well in the league, really. This is a team that needs to add 3 or 4 more players, get everybody fit, make sure that there's some semblance of form that they can play their way into by the time of the Super 8s.
But why is that? Why?
Because they have big game.
You're right, but why is that? It's because of their age profile.
Because, yeah, and they have big game experience, and they have know-how, and they have a management team that you believe in, and they've got all the accoutrements that you need for a good quality team to be able to do everything you need to do to put it up to Dublin.
Yeah, like, I know we'll get into it later on, but just one final point to that. Like, I agree with you, and I'm a little bit mostly steadfast in my opinion that Mayo should be there and thereabouts in terms of challenging Dublin come the summertime. But on the evidence of what we see in the league is actually a fantastic ground to actually decipher who's got the best kids. Like, whose players who actually want to make a point are actually the best group of players. And really, are Mayo's kids better than Galway's kids? The answer is no. Like, and I've been whenever I get the opportunity to bash Galway football, I absolutely will. But I'm not sure on the evidence of Saturday, is the future brighter for Galway than it is for Mayo? I think it might be. Like, and I know that's a worrying sign for Mayo in the long term, but you can also say this year, Mayo, I think, should be fine when it comes to actually getting back to making a challenge. But in the next couple of years, you've got to be very encouraged from Galway's perspective and not at all from Mayo's perspective.
What does a Connacht title mean to either of them this year, though? Nothing.
It means a lot. Not the title, but going through the front door would mean a lot to Mayo because of the reasons you just said there, because of the age profile. They can't go through the back door again this year. They really can't. I would like to see an under-25s league played in Ireland. And I would like to see how Mayo fare in that. Would they even be a Division 1 team?
Would they?
I'm not sure they would. Galway definitely would be. Dublin and Kerry definitely would be. Are Mayo a top 3 team? I think they're a top 3 team full stop. Are they a top 3 team when it comes to their under-25s?
They're under-25s. You're a fictional under-25 league. You're putting Mayo in Division 2. That's what I hear.
Potentially.
Right, I want to show you some of this. It wasn't a great weekend for Irish sports fixtures attendees, but it was a great weekend for Irish sports photographers because the snow was general all over Ireland. And so there was racing on Sunday. Is that at Leopardstown? That is Leopardstown, yeah. I don't know what the attendance was like, given that the snow, maybe it started early enough. Ah, they're great photographs, aren't they?
Mm.
This is the kind of the day that the photographer dreams of. Months and months, they're like the owners waiting for good ground. The Kerry Hurlers. There was one spectator of the Kerry Hurlers.
No, there was one spectator in the terrace, which made no sense. Why would anybody go to the terrace when there was a full stand to be taken care of?
Because you can stand under the press box.
That's true.
Hey, yeah, I can't believe you're libeling one of your buddies here. yeah, Kerry won that game?
They did, very comfortably.
You didn't step out to watch it, you were inside drinking?
No, it's just a bit behind. Just
in the pub.
Yeah, my schedule is a little bit. I know it's a terrible, terrible thing to have done, and I should be banished from all Kerry games in future. I did want to get a peek at Dublin in the first half, And, you know, instead of watching the Kerry hurlers, I can confirm that the Darren Gavin hype is real. From getting to see the first half of that game yesterday. That's all I wanted to do. Just a bit of surveillance before the Croke Park showdown in the league final, when Darren Gavin will slalom through Kerry and put us back in our box. So I got to see the future yesterday, is all I'm saying. The very near future.
But Dublin weren't great in the first half.
True, but he was great. And he's really turned into, like, it's just like clockwork at this point. Who are the one or two players that Dublin are going to find, or not even find, turn into a top-class talent? Like, people will have known about Darren Gavin over the last couple of years, but he's going to be the player that they turn into a top-level player this year. Potentially, even Fenton and Gavin is the way they're going to go forward in terms of their midfield. Can James McCarthy get into the Dublin midfield? It's almost a question you have.
Well, they're a better half-back line if you're playing half-back, right?
That's the thing. So are Dublin actually improved again this year from where they were last year?
Yeah,
Conor Callaghan is certainly one of the players who will improve from where he was last year. It was kind of a second season syndrome thing with him last year. So, like, you think of those two players and the knock-on effect it has with McCarthy going back to the half-back line.
I think Cormac Costello is also starting to fulfil his potential.
Well, that too.
I think it's fair to say that, like, yeah, is he four All-Ireland medals already and now he's getting good, or really good, or unmanageable. Right, so let's play you this, because in the aftermath of the nil-all draw at Goodison Park yesterday, Nathan ended up wandering down having a chat with Seamus Coleman. Here he is talking about Declan Rice. Have a look.
Of course, massively disappointing. He's a top player and we're seeing that week in, week out. But Declan Rice, his career now, and good luck to him with England, but I think that subject needs to stop. He's not an Irish player anymore, and I think yourselves and everyone else, I know you have to talk about it, but you're talking about an English player, so there's no point.
Alright, we look forward to seeing you over the next couple of weeks.
Cheers, thank you.
Cheers, Seamus, thanks.
Yeah, so Seamus Coleman, admitting everybody's disappointed, I think, because he's a good player. It's true, and it's fine. That's fine. That's like totally fine to say, right? As opposed to, nothing to do with us anymore. Screw you. Which was like very immature, I thought.
Yeah.
Because we were like dying for this guy, and it's like, no, I never wanted you in the first place. I mean, come on. But it's James Coleman, our captain, our leader. But, you know, he's not his captain. Mick McCarthy hasn't named him captain because I haven't picked a team yet. I don't have a captain. I don't know whoever. I mean, maybe I might pick Matt Doherty. Pick James Coleman and make him your captain. Mm. Find room for Doherty in your team. No?
Yeah. To try and get them both in, maybe, is one of the logical steps.
Here's what's coming up. We're going to go to the Premier League in just a minute. David Brady's going to join us at 8:30 to talk GAA, weekend's Gaelic football. Alan Quinn is going to join us around about 10 to 9. And Darren's going to be in around about 8:45. Quick look at the newspaper headlines. Redemption runs earn double bronze. So this is the picture of Kieran McGean and Mark English in Glasgow. Wintry weather plays havoc with hurling fixture schedule. Loads of games cancelled at the weekend. It's Monarchy Clerkin's roundup of everything else that happened. Klopp irked at notion Liverpool failed to go for jugular. Ireland's Bronze Age. McGean and English step up to mark with European medal success. It's a great picture of the two of them there. It's a third bronze for Mark English in the European Championships. The Racing Post. Derby draw. Dent Reds title hopes. And Sheffield Wednesday versus Sheffield United is the big game that they're previewing in the back there. Gordon Elliott is answering questions for the Racing Post today, and it's no joke, the near tropical conditions in Britain and Ireland early last week seemed a distant memory at Leopardstown yesterday as the card was staged in driving snow. A great photograph there. And McManus stars to miss festival over handicapping fears. So this is a big story. The Cheltenham Festival's top owner JP McManus has taken three leading handicap fancies out of his squad due to a belief they are badly treated compared to other Irish trained entries. Jesky Ivanovic Gorbatov, both contributors to their owner's hall of 54 festival triumphs, and the name escapes me, will not be among those carrying the golden green hooped silks at Cheltenham. It was revealed yesterday.
Back page of the Herald this morning is "I believe." It's a quote from Jurgen Klopp, who's keeping the faith as Liverpool bid falters and Dubs are getting stronger. It's Anthony Cunningham's quotes after they went down to Dublin yesterday against in Dr Hyde Park. He says their A versus B games are probably the most competitive games they're going to get, said Anthony Cunningham, despite the fact that they, of course, have lost two games in the National League so far this year. Back page of the Irish Daily Mail is "Bronze Pride, McGean and English delight at Euro display, while weather wreaks havoc with hurling fixtures," says Philip Lanigan here. Yeah, great picture there on the back. Glasgow kiss is the caption. Kieran McGean kisses the flag while Mark English reacts just after his finish in Glasgow. It's football on most of the rest of the tabloids this morning. The Sun goes with "Gone with the Wind." Klopp blames weather as title bids blown off course, and they think it's ball boy over. That's Jurgen Klopp's interaction with an Everton ball boy yesterday. And pick and Mick for Ireland Chiefs, says Owen Cowser this morning. Mick McCarthy has dropped a hint that Luton Town striker James Collins is in line for an Ireland call-up. And there's more news as well around Patrick Bamford, who'll go to the Irish Daily Star. Demolition derby is the main story. Klopp remains defiant despite Goodison flop. But Mick's set to meet Patrick is one I just wanted to mention here. So Mick McCarthy getting ghosted by Patrick Bamford apparently is over. Patrick Bamford was like, oh, sorry, not great with phones. I will get back to you, and we will sit down. And
need to get on Snapchat, Mick.
You will go for that coffee. Back page of the Mirror is gone with the wind. Reds title charge blown off course at breezy Everton, but the fine Klopp roars, I believe. And then finally, a couple of the UK back pages. The Guardian goes with, it's not like PlayStation. Klopp anger at suggestions he did not attack enough at Everton. Now, the point of like the PlayStation games is trying to model it as much on real-life football as possible. Like, I often say that it's like, oh, why didn't you, like, move the ticker up this way, kind of press a little bit more, or when you make those offensive substitutions. Like, the artificial intelligence is based on actual intelligence.
Yeah.
Like, PlayStation is getting closer and closer and closer to you, Jurgen Klopp, basically. And he's saying it's they're still very different things.
No.
Which they are. They are obviously very, very different things.
I'm a club on this.
But people are saying that...
You're slamming Jurgen Klopp for this.
I'm not slamming anybody. The Telegraph, though, are blowing it, they say. Salah wastes chances in Merseyside derby, but Klopp blames high winds as Liverpool drop crucial points in race for the title.
Yeah. All right, let's go on and talk about the football. We're going to join Gary Breen in 1 minute. First, though, here's the rest of Nathan's chat with Seamus Coleman after the Merseyside derby nil draw.
Very much so. We know what we're capable of, but we've not been, you know, as a team, we've not been nowhere near good enough. And we've had to look at ourselves a lot. We've had to chat to ourselves a lot and understand why. And I think one thing you've got to keep doing when things aren't going so well is just keep fully committed to the job, keep believing that you're doing the right things, and it'll turn. And at the minute, you know, it's just not been good enough, and there is that added pressure to play for this club. People maybe from the outside looking in don't understand the pressure of playing for this club, but when you get here you soon realise, and you know, the fans are unforgiving if you're not rolling your sleeves up for the cause. And I think, you know, as a group, we're all getting to terms with that. Obviously, I've been here a long time, but as you've seen from when lads do roll their sleeves up, you see the response that fans give us. So that's something that we need to look at going forward.
I'm sure you're going to tell me you don't think about Liverpool and you wanted to win that game, but you saw the reaction from the Everton supporters at taking 2 points off Liverpool and denting their run for the title. How big a factor is that? Is that something as Everton players you thought about?
I understand 100%. That's 100% where the fans would be. They don't want to see their rivals winning the league, and as Everton players, you don't want to see your rivals winning the league. But we just had to look at ourselves because our performance haven't been good recently, and try and put on a good performance, and we did that, and we actually wanted to win the win, which wasn't the case. But yeah, we've put a little dent in their title hopes, but they're still a very, very good side, and it's going to be a good battle between them and Manchester City.
Yeah. That was one of Owen's highlights of the weekend, revelling in others' misfortune.
Yeah, why not? It's something that's definitely become en vogue this season. I think we've all kind of come around to the realisation that we don't want Liverpool to win the Premier League unless you're a Liverpool fan.
I'm not in that... I would be delighted for Liverpool to be another viable season-after-season contender for the Premier League. It would be great.
It would be. Once you get beyond the point of actually...
The only way that can happen is if they actually win it once. Because look, here's the thing, right? Spurs, oh, we're contenders. Oh, no, we're not. Oh, we're contenders again. Oh, no, we're not. Oh, we're contenders again.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you're
and
not.
That's hilarious.
I mean, it's not really. It gets boring after a while because at some point, it's going to return to Manchester United and Chelsea and Man City, and that's it. And there'll be nobody else who'll be able to win it. So you need these other teams to actually come and win one.
But does that not just become the monotony after a while if another team comes along and just becomes a winning
happened,
team?
Apart from Leicester, which is like this complete random fluke, which, you know, in years to come people will go, oh, that's an interesting thing that happened there. But anyway, I think I'm not with you on this one. I'm not having it.
Like, I'm not, maybe I am out on a limb here, but I think the general feeling is that it will be rather funny to watch Liverpool lose the Premier League title from the position they were in. And it's not really as such a bottle job, to be quite honest, because this Manchester City team are outrageously good. And independently of that, you can also maintain that it's not a great feeling looking at this Manchester City team dominate English football.
Yeah.
Because there's kind of a cold sense around them. And there's, if you're comparing the two clubs, there's certainly a warmer sense around Anfield.
So you're attracted by the flat track bully who bought the success as opposed to the storied historic team that...
Like, reminders that life isn't fair can sometimes be a funny thing as well. And, like, it is definitely reveling in other people's misfortunes, and that probably says a lot more about me than anything else, but... Like, it's not really kind of anything personal, to be quite honest. I'm not, like, laughing at any of the Liverpool players on a personal level. I think they're actually quite a likeable squad, very likeable manager. I don't know, I think it's just the general aura around it, the historics, the amazing scenes that we would have seen had they won the Premier League. There's just something comical about it falling to pieces. But, like, again, I hate using that language about falling to pieces because... Has that actually been what's... Is that actually what's happened here over the last month or so?
What about
I think you're more of the belief that there's a bottle job going on here than I am, actually.
Well, I've changed my mind a little bit on that in the last 4 weeks. I think that the two big wins they had, and that was like the team is actually playing okay. And then these are big games that they're failing to win. And teams normally would fail to win some big games over a period of time because... that's what happens in the real world. It's just that it isn't happening when you've got a team as rich and successful and well-run as Manchester City. So in any normal year, this would look like an amazing title race. Liverpool would probably have a 3 or 4 point lead at this point, but they don't.
But the thing is, this thing also is not done, right? Like, I mean, you look at Manchester City's last two performances, 2-1-0 wins. Is this the sort of streaking away from Liverpool that we might have expected for people who are tipping Manchester City to go on and win the league title after they beat Liverpool at the start of the year, at the turn of the year? Like, I don't see that at the moment. Maybe it will happen eventually, but I still don't see this kind of streaking away from Liverpool happening. I still think this is a toe-to-toe title race for the next couple of months. And maybe that will change my opinion a little bit on this. Maybe Liverpool as a chaser now will actually become more of a thing that you want to see do well, see them actually go on and win this thing. But for the time being, I just find myself attracted to the cold, calculated menace of Manchester City.
Yeah.
Rich menace.
Yeah. They play nice football.
They do. They play nice football because they've injected loads of cash into it. And like, maybe there's kind of like a comedy to that as well, that the bad guy winning is just a scene that we don't see enough.
Well, I mean, we saw it a lot with Chelsea over the last decade or so. Speaking of Chelsea, Kenny Cunningham was at Fulham Chelsea for us. Here is... his thoughts on the top four race. Have a look.
So as we come into the closing stage of the season, the top four race, well, it looks like obviously Liverpool and Manchester City are going to take the top two places. Spurs are almost getting dragged back into that battle for the third and fourth positions. Chelsea are in there. They've got a game in hand, not too far behind United and Arsenal. So it's really four teams going for two spots. Who can you see emerging victorious at the end of the season?
Oh, it's a great call. It really is. I'm going to stick with Spurs for one of the remaining two spots. Obviously, we know Manchester City, Liverpool fight out for the top two. I'm going to stick with Spurs, although they've lost their mojo a little bit of late, and as you say, they're getting reeled in a little bit into this race for the championship places, but I still feel as if they'll have enough. And then it's the last place, and a fight between Arsenal, Chelsea and Manchester United. I just feel as if in terms of momentum, I look at Manchester United, I don't expect to stay in the Champions League after next week. I think they'll be out, and if that's the case, they can really play week to week between now and the end of the season. Really good feel good factor around the club at the moment. Teams playing well, playing with confidence, and players really look to be pushing each other and are really together. So if you had to make me choose between Chelsea, Manchester United and Arsenal for that remaining place, I'd probably lean towards Manchester United.
Yeah, so that's Kenny's call. Gary Breen joins us this morning. Gary, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Morning, guys. I'm good, thank you.
Can you give us your thoughts on the top four then? Because at the moment, what Kenny Cunningham has told us is that he thinks the teams that are in the top four are going to finish in the top four. So as it stands, Manchester United are fourth, Spurs are third, and obviously Liverpool and Man City, everybody expects that to happen. But it's hard to see Man United not making the top four with the form they're in at the moment.
Yeah, listen, the momentum they've got, I agree with Kenny there. Spurs, massive result to avoid losing at home to Arsenal. That would have changed the whole complexion. But the very fact that they got away with it in the end, bearing in mind that Arsenal missed the last minute penalty, I do believe they'll stay in there. I think they'll recover. I just think it's been a dreadful week for Tottenham. They'll be able to wipe their mouth of it this week, go again. And I think the very fact that I agree with Kenny, that I think United will go out of the Champions League and they'll be able to concentrate solely on that. With Arsenal, Chelsea, you just never know what you're going to get at the moment. And that consistency that United have had under Solskjaer, I think it will serve them well and it will get that Champions League spot.
The consistency that they've had is something that we probably need to talk a little bit more about, because it's almost irrespective of the personnel now. He can change things around, he can have his team, he can have different players come in, he can have a different style. It's been a fairly remarkable display of managerial capacity so far.
It's a huge credit to him that he's been able to do that. Even for we saw Fred come on and have an influence late on in the game, and he's one of the ones who hasn't really impressed, one of the few since Solskjaer has taken over. But even the turnaround in Lukaku, he looked strong, he looked powerful. In contrast to at times when he can look a little bit too bulky, a little bit cumbersome, he gets his two goals. And just watching that game, the late winner against Southampton, the whole mood of that game, the very fact that, listen, and I've been there, two tight penalty decisions go in their favour. Then you see the fact that they get the equaliser, then they quickly get that second. That used to happen all the time. And then that late winner as well. So the mood, everything seems to be going right for Solskjaer at this moment in time. He comes out after the game and says things like, it felt like the old days. And he's just saying exactly the right things where the supporters are buying into it. And the hierarchy have got a decision now that it would literally feel like mutiny if he didn't get the job.
It's funny. It does feel like the old days, though. He's actually just telling the truth about that. That there is, you know, I think a lot of people who probably look back at the Ferguson era or only caught the end of the Ferguson era don't realise that various Man United teams, but certainly the early ones, they could easily, regularly be down in games and not playing well and dig out results. It wasn't that they were this machine that they later on became when they had the Ronaldo team, where they would just win all the games all the time. And even the second team with the class of 92, when they got into their stride, they would win 10, 12 games in a row, and you kind of feel like that was it. But the early stages of Alex Ferguson's reign was this dramatic week after week roller coaster where the team would frequently be behind at Old Trafford and they would need the crowd to carry them through. And that symbiotic relationship between the players and the crowd seemed to completely be impossible given the size and scale of the stadium and the fact that they're now full of tourists week after week. But that's not the case. That somehow Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has managed to bring it back.
Yeah, it is. And it kind of mirrored the manager's image in terms of the fact they never say die, they never give up. But ultimately, what has changed and certainly feels like those days now is that as a player going to United, there would have been the rare occasions that you were leading with 20 minutes to go, but you never felt confident enough that you see it through. You knew there'd be an onslaught. It'd be difficult to keep them out. But there was periods under Mourinho, under Van Gaal, where players now, the opposing teams, were literally going to Old Trafford and thinking, we're going to win this. And invariably, you'd see teams getting those type of results. You don't feel that now. Even when it got to that late stages and it looked like Southampton were going to get a much-needed point, you always felt that United would keep banging on the door and it would force a way through, and it proved that way.
Yeah. The other thing that I've seen the Man United fans really happy about is that Solskjaer also seems to be very tactically adept and understands that there was a couple of games early in the year where afterwards he diagnosed that the team had been overrun in midfield. He was talking about the improvement that the defence has made, and he was basically putting that down to the fact that the midfield now understood that their role was to help the defence out and to be disciplined. And there was much more tactically nuanced language than that. He knows what's going on, and he's actually willing to communicate it.
Yeah, listen, I think he has. I think it's been more than just a feel-good factor, and I think that was a bit remiss of ex-players like Paul Ince saying that anyone could have come in and done it, because he has shown a good tactical awareness. I think the first time we saw it, and the biggest challenge he had initially was going away to Tottenham. He played split strikers and encouraged Spurs to kind of attack from their fullbacks like they did, and they put them to the sword in the first half. Obviously, De Gea kept them in it with 11 saves in the game, and the second half performance wasn't that impressive. But we have seen it. He is tactically astute. I think the way United are playing now, he's playing to the strength of the players. More often than not, they counter-attack, and why wouldn't they with the blistering pace that they have up front, the running energy they have from Pogba, and it served them well. But you're right, you can't do that. You can't put on a good defensive performance if you don't have a disciplined midfield. And it's something we're seeing now in stark contrast to under Mourinho, who probably had them all back, and at times the centre forward would be isolated. You never feel that they're isolated now. They're attacking with real verve. But a standout mention as well to likes of Smalling. I'm not convinced he is a United quality centre-half, but he has been excellent in the last few weeks. Liverpool was the standout. But for me, I saw United at Fulham, and he had the physicality to deal with Mitrovic. It was incredible. He bullied Mitrovic. And more often than not, you see Mitrovic doing that to centre-halves. Certainly, we've seen him do it to Ireland, Shane Duffy, Dunker Brighton, really put him to the sword. But Smalling has been impressive in recent weeks.
Yeah. How does that happen? Is that because he's got a manager now who believes in him? Is that just he's maturing at a very late stage? Like, why is that? Is that something that you have to give the manager credit for too? Or is that just kind of, you know, a rising tide lifts all boats?
Yeah, no, I think I would give the majority of the credit there to the manager. He's obviously spoken to him, said, I rate you highly, blah, blah, blah. And as a result, then he has that confidence to go out there in a similar way to Lindelof. He's impressed as well. At times this season, certainly early in the season, he looked like an apprentice playing for United or a young centre-half. And not a young centre-half in the mould of John O'Shea, more like a Scott Wootton and Michael Keane, who didn't look good enough for that level. But he has impressed recently as well. And I think it's just a whole feel-good factor. They're enjoying it all the time. You're hearing them saying, we love coming into work. So that credit must go to the manager.
In kind of a strange way, Gary, is there something that Manchester United can do by looking at Liverpool in terms of giving them massive amounts of hope for next season? Because we saw what one defensive signing, and they already have a good goalkeeper, but one defensive signing in Virgil van Dijk last season could do to transform Liverpool at the back. As you mentioned, they probably do need another addition in that area, but also with a manager who really believes in the squad, a manager who's kind of a friend of the team. And like the unbelievable contrast we've seen from Liverpool this year, from kind of being well off the top to actually being a proper title contender, they must look at that and say, well, under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, we may be where we are now, but the possibility for a huge leap forward next year with these few tweaks is actually quite possible.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, but I don't think there's many Van Dijks out there. That's the problem. Sure. I think he's a type of centre-half that solves many problems. But if what we're led to believe is true, that Alvaro Varela may possibly go into United because his contract situation at Tottenham doesn't look like it's going to be resolved. He is a centre-half who can impact. Because I do, as much as I've just admired how well they've done defensively, I'm going to counter that and maybe contradict myself by saying that's not a defence winning, that's not a title winning defence at United, Manchester United, by no stretch of the imagination. So there are improvements needed there. Shaw's looks rejuvenated again. He looks very good in terms of how well he's playing. But I would agree there. I mean, I don't think it's a massive jump from where they are to being coming title challenges, but I do think they're two or three players short.
The biggest naysayers of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will probably point to the first leg against Paris Saint-Germain as evidence as to why he may not be the man for the Manchester United job. I think that's a little bit harsh myself. But ultimately, even if they are to crash out of the Champions League this week, a spirited second leg showing against Paris Saint-Germain where Solskjaer doesn't get out-tacticked, so to speak, might be a huge positive for him in terms of getting this job.
Well, yeah, I mean, from the first leg, everyone maybe made the accusation that PSV dominated that midfield area, that they took control of the game. United couldn't get any foothold in it. So straight away, then you look at the manager. But you have to put it in context. This is a team that he inherited was 11 points out of the top four places. So the reality is, can they really compete with Europe's best? Not really, I wouldn't say. I know the momentum has taken them so far, but that is still a massive jump from who they're beating in the Premier League to suddenly going up against Europe's best, even without the likes of Neymar, Cavani in the team. So I don't expect them to go there and win. I don't think we'll see something like the win in terms of the win that they got in Turin against Juventus, which surprised everyone. It was out of the blue. I don't really see that happening this week.
Let's move on and talk a bit about Arsenal, because obviously the race top. Go on.
I was at the game.
Yeah.
I was at the game and I was so impressed with them. And Owen, you'd be delighted to hear that. And so many Arsenal players, supporters, is that you could see the work that Emery had done. The actual selection was a surprising one. The very fact that he played Mustafi at right back. But in terms of how they played, so organised, is out of possession. They were brilliant in terms of how they set up, to the extent that when you think about Tottenham, they're normally so good at playing through the thirds, playing through that midfield area and then getting players in space in the 10 area. They couldn't do any of that. Tottenham resorted to playing long ball football. But as is always the case with Arsenal, they break your heart. They were going nowhere, Tottenham, until Mustafi done that ridiculous decision to give away that penalty. Why he's doing that, I don't know. I know everyone will argue it's offside, Harry Kane on the initial ball in, but nevertheless, as a defender, he just needs to go square on, take Kane under the ball that way, as opposed to turning his back and bumping him that way and giving a referee a decision to make. And I was impressed. Mkhitaryan was sensational, disciplined, countered at pace, was so good. Even Monreal at left-backs was disciplined, stayed in there and stayed behind the game and joined in. But Xhaka, who I was watching, you're thinking, yeah, you're playing quite well. I mean, that tackle on Kane's a disgrace. And he made about three or four of them. He's a liability.
Mm. The thing is, it was so close to a masterstroke on every level, Gary, because first of all, just on a pure results basis, going to Wembley and getting a 1-0 win, closing the gap to Spurs to 1 point would have been huge. But it would have been the way he did it in terms of the strength of Unai Emery in that dressing room, the fact that he can say, no, I'm going to leave you on the bench to Torreira, to Ozil and to Aubameyang and still go and get the 3 points. It would have been a win-win-win for Unai Emery, and he must be doubly disappointed because of that.
Yeah, because of the late penalty, to not put that away, Aubameyang was surprising, really, bearing in mind how prolific he has been since he turned up in the Premier League. I think only Salah scored more goals than him. But it was right, you're right, to have those three quality players on the bench and to win that game and to win it the way they did, because Tottenham were unrecognisable. I know, listen, Tottenham were wounded in terms of their title challenge, literally falling apart in the space of a week. But had Arsenal won that game, you'd have feared for Tottenham in terms of staying in that top four. Now I think they'll regroup. I think obviously they've got one foot in the quarterfinals. They'll go to Dortmund. They'll protect that 3-0 lead, I would expect, and probably go from strength to strength. But that was a real missed opportunity for Arsenal. There's absolutely no doubt. And in terms of keeping those players on the bench, Ozil came on for about the last 20, 25 minutes. And I have no doubt his role would have been playing 10. When we get the ball, look after it. Just keep the ball for us. Keep possession so that Tottenham can't build any momentum. He was absolutely redundant. He didn't do a thing. And to anyone who argues, why is Ozil not making this starting 11, of which I would be one of them, that was the perfect example. He contributed absolutely nothing in those final 20 minutes.
So I think Arsenal fans have to be pretty happy with what they're seeing, considering where they've come from. Like, the Wenger era is over properly, and they have a manager who is making progress slowly, but yeah, it's definitely progress, right?
It is progress, but the problem with it is that these players that he wants to take Arsenal are not good enough. They're just not good enough, Mustafi and stuff. And that's a difficult thing to say, because obviously people say, well, listen, he's a World Cup winner. He's a good player. He's a mid-table Premier League player. He's not a defender who can take you away, nor is Xhaka in centre midfield. And this is a problem that Emery will have, is that he has to persevere with him. He's not going to have any type of financial muscle in the transfer window. We're led to believe he's got about 50 million to spend. That's not going to solve the problems. And the problem that ultimately he has is that he has a player who he doesn't feel will contribute on 350 grand a week. Now, he'll create some wealth within his squad by the fact that Ramsey's going, Petr Cech's going, Welbeck were going. So that's effectively about 300 grand's worth in wages. But even then, you're looking at him thinking, they really are struggling, Arsenal. They'll find it hard to bridge the gap to the top two.
Yeah, you've got to pack Ozil off to China or whatever they can do with him to get rid of him.
But is he not like one of the only avenues that Arsenal have, Gary, in terms of actually penetrating the top four if they manage to get cut adrift a little bit? I agree with you that he was really bad when he came on, but then you look at his Bournemouth performance last week.
And oh, yeah,
at his peak, Gary, he's probably Arsenal's best player in terms of pure raw talent.
I absolutely agree with you. And I was really banging the drum about the fact, why didn't he start the game? He's a player that even Pochettino would have said, listen, I hope he doesn't play. And I do believe that too often, Ozil is used as a crutch to cover the sins of all the other players. It's too easy to go to Ozil and say, well, look at him, and some of those other players get away with murder. But I do agree with you. I do think he's the difference. And if you think about Arsenal this season, the lack of chances created is a staggering drop from last season and the last couple of seasons, because Ozil's not playing. And even his stats in terms of what he has contributed when he plays, it's there for all to see. But he just proved that you cannot give him a start in a North London derby. The blood, thunder, guts, whatever you want to say it, he just can't cope with it. He was actually shying away from tackles, pulling out of it. And I was always of the opinion where I'd have that type of player who has that ability to open, unlock teams, and I would build a team around him. And as a player, I'd say, yeah, I'll do the hard yards for you, I'll do the tackling for you, but you must create. But when you come on and do that and you're pulling out of challenges and you're not getting hold of the ball, it's very difficult to create a team spirit that would accept that within that changing room.
Yeah, good stuff, Gary. Thanks a million for joining us this morning.
Thanks, guys.
Gary Breen, give us some thoughts on Derby weekend. We're going to turn attention to the other Derby now. And first, before we get to Gareth Roberts from the Anfield Wrap, here's Kevin Coban and Nathan reacting to Liverpool and Everton stalemate. Have a look.
These sides met in the space of a fortnight back in December, and Liverpool took 6 points from the games against Everton and Manchester United at home, and it was the substitutes that made the difference. The substitutes over the last week that Jurgen Klopp's made, considering there's a feeling they do have a bit more depth, did he get his changes right? He took Mo Salah off last week, he took Sadio Mane off this week?
I was surprised that Mo Salah went off last week. That's certainly the case. Sadio Mane was having little impact on the game today. Now, you can look at it and maybe say you're looking at his bench and you're looking at Shaqiri. Where was Shaqiri in the last couple of games? Why wasn't he getting on sooner? Why didn't he come on today? That is a thing that I'm maybe looking at if I'm thinking of Shaqiri there, because I think he's the one that might be able to change that game today. Because simply that sort of game-changing play that they actually brought to the football club. Mane, you spoke about him prior to the game today, the form that he's in. he didn't have a lot in the game, did he? That was the thing. I thought a lot of the balls were bouncing off him. Now, that was largely down to Zouma and Keane that played up against him. I thought they played really well up against him because he's played through the middle today as a number nine, and he had very little influence on the match. So, substitutions, yes. Yes, I would say ultimately he probably could have got one or two of those decisions or made one or two a different decision. Although, when James Milner came on, he did make an impact on that game. He put two or three brilliant crosses in that Liverpool were failing to do throughout. So if I'm looking at it from that sort of side of it, perhaps maybe he got one right and perhaps another one wrong.
All right, let's get the views of Gareth Roberts from the Anfield Wrap on the game yesterday. Gareth, it's at that point of the season where things are getting squeaky bum time, I think is the phrase I'm really looking for here. What's the general sense now from Liverpool fans of where the team is with regards to a potential title win?
Rails a little bit. I don't think we can lie about that. I mean, the draws aren't ideal. But what I would say is that, you know, Liverpool have done brilliantly to get to this point. And we just all need to keep our nerve as a collective, the fans, the manager, the team. And I just think, you know, there's been plenty of Liverpool seasons where we've got 50-odd points in a whole season, 60-odd points in a whole season. We're on 70 points at this point. And City now, it's in their hands. If they go and win all the nine games remaining, they can finish on 98 points. Liverpool can finish on 97. If Liverpool finish on 97 points, it's the most points they've ever amassed in the history of the club. And I just think it has to be put into that perspective. You know, we can't do this thing where we just analyse match by match and say, OK, Liverpool are great if they win and they're not great if they draw. The draws recently have been Everton away, United away, Bayern Munich. I mean, these aren't easy games. And I just think Everton sort of seen in the context of basically a couple of chances. If Mo puts one of them chances away yesterday, we're sitting here having a very different conversation. It's not like Liverpool were absolutely awful. They were fairly comfortable at the back. The defence has remained strong. We haven't conceded a goal for 7 hours. So there's not, for me, loads and loads wrong. We just need to now go out and win, and the margin for error has completely gone now. And as I say, it is in City's hands. But I look at City's fixture list and I see difficult games there. And, you know, they've already lost games that no one expected them to lose. No one expected them to lose at Newcastle. No one expected them to lose to Leicester and Crystal Palace. So, you know, there's still hope there and we've just got to keep on going.
Gareth, when you talk about everybody needs to hold their nerve, it's mostly important. I mean, the team are going to hold their nerve, I think, because they're professionals and this is their job. It's the fans and making sure that doesn't become contagious somehow. It's an impossible thing to ask of any fan base who are, you know, so close to ending the famine that they're in the midst of.
But we have to, because, I mean, for me, the big concern, one of the most concerning moments of the season was when Virgil van Dijk said after the Leicester game at home that he could feel that they, on the pitch, they could feel the nerves of the fans. And for me, that's all gone wrong. That thing's gone on its head, because we're there to support. We're there to make them feel better. We're there to encourage them, discourage the other team, appeal for everything, make it a bear pit, make it our Anfield, if you like, not the other team's Anfield. And so I thought Liverpool fans reacted really well to that. I thought the atmosphere for Bournemouth, which was a 3 p.m. on a Saturday against a mid-table side, was brilliant. You know, Liverpool fans reacted really well. I think Liverpool fans can react really well again when we play Burnley on Sunday. Again, you know, Burnley on Sunday, 12 o'clock kickoff, not ideal circumstances for a football match or for supporting a football match. But I think Liverpool fans will react again, and I think Liverpool will react again.
Is it a different place, Gareth, at all to Anfield in previous recent title-challenging years? Is it a more nervous place at all? Like you say, it's a great atmosphere, but so by the sounds of things, it really isn't a nervous place that some people have been trying to paint the picture as.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I don't know whether to go as far as say it's mischief-making, but look, you know, this is the way the media is, isn't it? It looks for negativity. You know, it sells newspapers and it gets clicks if you say Liverpool are in crisis, Liverpool have blown it, Liverpool have bottled it. I think that Leicester game was the only one, really, where there was a huge amount of nerves around the ground. As I say, Liverpool fans reacted positively. And since then, you know, the atmospheres have been good. And I think, you know, you're very right to say earlier that it's the fans who need to keep the nerve here. And it's some of our fans who are bottling it for me, not Liverpool as a group, as a group of players or the manager. We need to hold our nerve. We need to keep back in the side. And even things on social media, I think all that counts. Because the players look at it. The players are only human as well. And so if they can just see us as a collective having a massive wobble and saying, that's it, we've blown it, you know, that could creep into their minds. I think we've got to put it into the perspective of what I said earlier, which Liverpool is that Liverpool have done brilliantly to top Man City all this time, now only be a point behind them. And, we, you know, we've still got 9 games and 27 points to play for. It's basically a quarter of the season. So, you know, we do need to hold our nerve and we do need to realise where we are. We're in a great place and it's a brilliant opportunity to win the league still.
I'm not sure how much you interact with fans from other clubs, Gareth, and I'm sure you might have kept your distance from Everton fans yesterday who were chanting, "You'll win nothing now," and naturally they got a lot of pleasure from yesterday's result. Is that kind of a league-wide thing at the moment, that there's a general attitude that people would rather see this drought for Liverpool go on?
There does seem to be a lot of that around. I mean, I expect it from Everton fans. I expect it from Manchester United and Manchester City fans. I'm not sure why some other groups of fans are bailing in, because, you know, ultimately, isn't it quite boring if Manchester City win the league?
Yes.
Isn't it quite boring if they keep winning the league year after year after year? Wouldn't it be quite nice to see a different name at the top of the league? Wouldn't it be quite nice that a team, you know, that no one tipped Liverpool to win the league at the start of the season? If they do it, doesn't that give everyone else hope? I don't quite understand, you know, the sort of, oh no, Liverpool fans would be intolerable if they won the league. Well, aren't any group of fans intolerable if they win the league? I don't really sort of get the idea that we're this special set of people. We just want to win the league. As I said earlier, you know, it's been 29 years. I've been going to match every one of those 29 years, and I'd really like to see us win the league. And if we win it, I will celebrate.
Yeah.
I will think. I will go mad. And I'm sure that's the same for any set of fans.
I was at that Bournemouth game that you're talking about. The atmosphere was unbelievable. I did feel that there was a real nervousness after the first goal went in. There was celebration for about 5 minutes, and then everybody got back to being a little bit worried because we were 1-0 up last week and we got pegged back. And then when they went 2-0 up, they're like, oh, this is the worst league in football. There was just a little bit of that in the crowd. But when it went 3-0, everybody was happy. And you can see, I can see Liverpool winning a load of games routinely over the course of the rest of the season. So I could easily see some of these 4-0s followed by a tricky game, because the team does seem to be capable of reaching very high heights intermittently at the moment, and it's that lack of consistency really in the performance that over the last couple of weeks, it hasn't been title winning form from them since they were sensational in December. What is the difference in the performance on the pitch, do you think, apart from the stuff that we've talked about with the fans?
I think at times, you know, you haven't seen the free-flowing football. I mean, against Bournemouth there was some really good football. You know, you're seeing Mo Salah and Firmino link up brilliantly in a way where all season we've been saying, you know, we want to see the front three click. That phrase has been used an awful lot this season. And we've seen flashes of it against Bournemouth. Obviously, we put 5 past Watford. But then, you know, I just don't think, you know, what we saw yesterday is a very, very determined Everton. Everton going out to an air raid siren. Everton absolutely pumped to break up Liverpool's title challenge. And look, they got the point, and that's their best result for 24 years, and good on them, great. There's no trophy for it, but, you know, it feels like there is the way they're all celebrating. But I don't think Liverpool come up against sides as committed as that from here on in. I think Everton wanted that so much, the manager wanted it so much, the fans, as I say, were absolutely pumped, and the atmosphere at Goodison was very good. But I think, you know, as you've just said, there will be more routine games that Liverpool face now. Equally, City have got some tough games of their own. They've got to go to Manchester United. They've got to play Spurs. Even games like Palace and Burnley away aren't ideal. And you could see them slipping up. And I mean, you know, look, it's the margins are so fine, as I said earlier. Mo Salah puts one of those chances away. We're having a different conversation. City, you know, could have got frustrated against Bournemouth, but ultimately found a way. But, you know, on another day they draw. So it's not like, it's just not done and dusted for me, despite, you know, this idea that that's it, it's all over. You know, the league's never been handed out in March. It's handed out in May, so let's see what happens.
On Mo Salah, Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian this morning says he has scored just once in his last 7 games and looked distinctly tentative here. There were occasional flashes of the old brilliance, but for much of the game, Salah played the way Jordan Henderson's critics believe he plays. Are you worried about Salah's form at the moment, Gareth?
I think what we saw yesterday was a little bit worrying in that on both the big chances, I think he takes an extra touch that he doesn't really need to. And perhaps he's doing that thing where he wants to make sure rather than he actually just playing his natural game. I thought against Watford, though, he was decent. He played really well. He was running at defenders. He was causing havoc. And that was the Mo Salah that we know and love. And I think he's still right up there in the scoring chart, if not top, you know, joint second, something like that. I don't think there's anything to worry about. I think, you know, his level of performance since he became a Liverpool player has been incredible. And again, it has to be put into that context. Yesterday, okay, not his finest day, and I understand why people look at that and look for a problem. But, you know, if Liverpool was to sell him tomorrow, what's he worth? He's worth an absolute fortune. Why is he worth an absolute fortune? Because he's been brilliant for Liverpool.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the point you're making about Liverpool needing to realise that they're up against one of the great teams in this City team, that has to be part of the narrative, as opposed to Liverpool choking for the rest of the season. And the other thing is that, like, it feels like this isn't going away anytime soon for Liverpool. There are with Suarez, for example, and Brendan Rodgers and that team, it felt like that was a one-shot wonder where a lot of teams had become weak. This is a Liverpool side that have built steadily season on season under Jurgen Klopp. As long as Klopp stays and as long as the club isn't sold and something weird doesn't happen in the background, this is the new normal, or should be, for Liverpool.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, look, when we were in Kiev, when Liverpool lose the Champions League final, I had a worry in the back of my mind that, you know, things fall apart from there on in. And we've seen it so often before in the past with Liverpool, that it's been boom and bust, that they manage a title challenge and then they fall off a cliff. You're right to say that it looks like it's sustained this time. Klopp's there for the long term. All the key players have signed long-term contracts. I think that's important. You've got players there like Trent Alexander-Arnold, who looks like he can kick on and improve. He's still a young player. He will be an absolutely brilliant player for Liverpool. So everything points to the fact that this is the norm, as you say, that they can keep on challenging. And that's what Liverpool need to do. What still irks me more than anything, really, is that we allowed, among other teams, of course, but we allowed Leicester City to win the league. And they were crowned champions with something like 77 or 78 points. They went on to amass a few more, but it was that at that point that they were told they were champions. Liverpool have won more points than that in the Premier League and not being crowned champions. The point is, you have to be there or thereabouts time and time again. And one year, it will be your year, as everyone likes to crow about that Liverpool fan. So another thing I don't really understand. Of course, you're going to say it's our year, because that's what fans do. And one year it will be, and it might be this year. And if it's not this year, it might be next year. But Liverpool have got to keep on going. And as you say, all the key players are in place. 13-14, it felt like Liverpool were in the red zone all the time. And then, you know, right at the end of the season, they didn't have enough left in the tank. And we all know what happened. This time around, I just think it's a really solid basis for what Liverpool have done. Some of the football hasn't been champagne football, but it's been mature football. They found a way to win while not always necessarily playing well. And it's on the basis of a good defence, a brilliant centre-half, a brilliant goalkeeper. They're not going away, they're not going anywhere, and neither are Liverpool.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Gareth, enjoy as much as you possibly can the rest of the season. Great to have you with us this morning. Thanks, man.
Thanks, mate.
That's Gareth Roberts from the Anfield Wrap there, which all Liverpool fans I know rave about as a source of good quality information.
Is it disrespectful to start talking about Liverpool keeping their nerve after the season? Like, when he talks about keeping their nerve, I often think to that, like, as he said there, that's also about the future and not just about the present. It was about keeping their nerve after they lost the Champions League final last year and taking the step forward this season.
And they did that, yeah? No?
They did that, but, like, is it disrespectful to start talking about that now when the title race is still very much alive?
So it's not over.
Because it feels to me, if you talk about Liverpool keeping their nerve beyond the season, we're riding them out of the title race, there's going to be one more twist in this.
There is.
This thing is still very much live. But maybe most of us actually just wanted to not be any more twists.
Well, City are going to have. Well, so is taking 3-2 home lead in the Champions League? We're in the 16. Is that a big? It's still a big enough game. Mm-hmm. Everybody has to get up for it. There'll be the next round, and there'll probably be one round after that that you would see City having to prepare for and come down from and get back up for the weekend. So the fixtures yet could be an issue for them. Anyway, let's move on because. David Brady joins us now to talk to us. We've been talking a good bit about Kerry already. We may as well roll straight in and start talking about Mayo. David, good morning to you. How are you doing?
Morning, Gus. How's it going, buddy?
What was your level of concern coming away from the game at the weekend? So, if anybody missed it, Galway squeaked out a win in Mayo against the Mayo side, who looked like they were kind of rolling in the second half for a while and getting back into it and probably going to kick on and win the game, but they just didn't manage to do that. So what's your level of concern at the moment?
Probably my concern there is the fluidity, I think, from some of Mayo's playing, especially in it's been plain to see in the last couple of games in the forward line. Like, you know, we knew coming into the game weather conditions and everything else was not going to be good, but I honestly feel that Galway went out with a more precise and conducive plan to play with conditions, and from the very start, Galway put massive pressure on David Clark's heels. No, they did this by letting Mayo keep three forwards versus two Galway backs. So Galway said, right, the wind is so strong, they're not going to be of any threat. Let's have one of our full back line go up and put pressure on David Clark right in front of his nose, 20 yards out. So he was covering so much space. It was just an option that there was massive pressure put on Mayo, and that's what gave Galway with the foundation for a first half lead of about 7 points. But look, it is 2015 since the last time Mayo managed to beat Galway in competitive football, and that for me, honestly, I didn't see that hunger or that willingness to end that run for vast quantities of the game. Now, yes, there was a period where the last 10 minutes Mayo came back to a point, but it was to say, right, what's the simplest things to do now? And it wasn't that the wrong options were taken, it was that the wrong percentages. And you're going, if you have the ball and you're maintaining possession, you know, the shot will open. If it's not, it's up to the defensive team, like Galway, to say, right, let's be disciplined and not give away a free. And in conditions like what we had on Saturday night, they're always going to be conducive to someone putting a hand in or someone getting an easy free. And that's what takes you back into a game, not a score from 55 yards out. But I was impressed overall with Galway. I was impressed with some of their younger players as well. You know, and it's especially said the likes of David Conan. He was in a corner forward halfback on Lee Keegan for the night, and he was very lively, very tricky, kept Lee very very busy and out of the Mayo game from an attacking context.
David, is it far too knee jerky to say now at this point that Galway are the number one team in Connacht?
Not at all. Galway have been the number one team in Connacht for the last 4 or 5 years, and trophies. Trophies prove that. Not getting to an Ireland final does not get you a prize to say now you're the best. The Connacht Championship has been as competitive championship in the whole of the country. And if you look at it, that's formed on the basis where you have two to three teams. And we've seen Roscommon put up a very good show against Dublin yesterday. You have two or three teams that can win the Connacht Championship.
Can I play devil's advocate for a second, David? Because I don't, the Connacht, all of the provincial titles have largely been devalued by the fact that what happens in Croke Park afterwards is what matters. Mayo are the only team in Connacht to get close to Dublin, bringing them to an All-Ireland final replay. We've never seen Galway put up a performance like that in Croke Park at any stage over the Kevin Walsh era. So while I understand the point you're making, in Connacht, Galway can go, oh, we're the best team in Connacht. But in the All-Ireland, Mayo have definitely been the better team.
They've been the second best team in every All-Ireland they've played. Now, again, I will be straight out there and saying that winning, losing an All-Ireland by a point and putting up a fantastic display or giving away two own goals or giving away silly decisions at crucial times in the game, that doesn't necessarily make it the best team in Connacht either. I would, without a doubt, and I put my hand up and saying, Galway have railroaded Mayo in the last couple of years, and there's a common denominator there, and that's Kevin Walsh as well, the way he sets his teams up. And like to win Connacht in the way that Galway have it at home, like Mayo's home record now is not an advantage anymore. You're losing consistently on a regular basis in Connacht Championships or in National League. Last year we had a worse percentage nearly away. We had a better percentage away from home than we had. It's not McHale Park is not the cauldron that it once was, and it's not respected by the opposition, because you're going, you know what? And this is the common denominator, and I go back to the start. When you have teams that set up in a defensive system, defensively pack their defence to make it harder than Mayo, so Mayo don't get them runners coming through. They don't get the counter breaks from the Keith Higgins, from the Lee Keegans, from the Colin Boyles going through. When you can set up in a defensive system, and what Galway have we all said it was Paddy Talley and everything else in the last year or whatever. It's still continuing. He's not there. It's coming from Kevin Watson. Let's start with defence and work on it from there. But I, for one, wouldn't buy into the notion that a good performance in an All-Ireland final, or being the only team to compete in an All-Ireland final to a degree against Dublin in the last 4 or 5 years, makes you the best team in Connacht.
Right. What's your sense in terms of what this is, in terms of what this James Horan project is for Mayo? Is it going to be, at best, a one-hit wonder where he goes and has one last punch at Dublin, perhaps in an All-Ireland final, and perhaps, in the best-case scenario, come away with Sam Maguire? Or is he actually looking to the future now, David? What's your take on what this project is?
He's trying to do the best of what he has, and that's being honest. But, you know, James did come at the start of the season and saying it was about the future, it was about building, it was about looking forward. But There was an event we had this year just before Christmas, and he says, let's not get confused here. He said, Mayo are out to win, and it's out to compete, and it's not to be beaten by anyone. And again, they will not be happy. Mayo will not be happy. James Horan will not be happy if he doesn't have silverware of some shape or form coming back to Mayo in the form of a Connacht title. And the supporters won't be happy either. But the one thing I do say is I loved the like of Matthew Ruan, who played midfield on Saturday night. He's coming from the under-21s. He was excellent. He worked immensely hard. Right, James Durkin played his first National League game. Now, he played 4 championship games last year, but how did the player only play his first National League game on the first weekend of March? You know, these guys should have been brought in a long time ago. Darren Cohn, very good footballer, took 3 or 4 bad options. He's playing full forward, was out around the 40, 45, scored one excellent point. But you're going, you know what? Learn from it. Don't do it again. Or if you do it again, make sure it counts. Now, there's good young fellas coming up, and he's trying to blend both. But if you look at it, the vast base, and 90% of this team is going to be based on the Keith Higgins, the Chris Barrett, Harrisons, Keegans, the Vaughans, the O'Shea's, and the O'Connors. Jamie came back Saturday night. Killian is a little bit off, but it's going to be based on what they've always had, the key players from the old that have brought them to where they've got to in Ireland finals.
Yeah, I can understand why you would do that, though, especially when it's your first year back. So, look, let's park Mayo discussion for a minute. I want to ask you about the other performance of the weekend. From Mayo's perspective, they're on the same side of the draw. Obviously, they've got the New York game, and after that, it is Leitrim or Sligo. Sorry, it's Leitrim or Roscommon. Pre-season, everybody would have said, well, that's a straightforward, Roscommon are going to win that. And Roscommon are doing really well, but Leitrim have obviously just got promoted, so let's hope they can maintain their form and roll into the Championship. Roscommon against Dublin was one of those games where Roscommon looked like they've built on what they've been doing for the last couple of seasons. And, you know, it was the type of sticky performance that maybe we weren't entirely sure Roscommon had in them.
No, but at the end of the day, it was Roscommon have, and again, if you look back, and what Kevin McPhail brought in was a lot of youth and a lot of opportunity, and them guys have taken the opportunity, but they haven't been overawed by it. Yesterday's game was when Dublin got the goal and went 4 points up, you're going, you know what, game over, job done. But no, and again, it goes back to the likes of Cathal Craig being immense, Conor Devaney. When he got his second yellow card, that was the end of it. You can't. It's hard enough to beat Dublin 15-15. But if you're down 14, if you're down to 14 men, it does make it very hard. But you make it hard for Dublin. The conditions and defensively, Roscommon played them to a T yesterday, and I think Anthony Cunningham has added to what the likes of Kevin McStay has done and Fergie Dolan before that. Yeah, you go to yourself. They have brought young teams on, and their defensive structure is very, very good, and that's the basis of what you see in a lot of the teams. Even though you go to the Leitrims, their defensive structure, they have tightened up defensively, and it's methodically as well. They have a system now that they're becoming accustomed and they're happy to play with. And you're saying, you know what? Yes, we do break up the channels from the left and right when we do break down ball. But it's they're going defensive number one now in GAA, and after that you look to try and score more than the other team.
David, we'll let you go. Good stuff this morning. Thanks a million for joining us.
Cheers, guys.
David Brady there giving us some thoughts on the weekend's Gaelic football action. We talked a little bit earlier on about how amazing Kerry were. So if you missed your Kerry fix, Owen basically announced that this Kerry team are going to win 2 or 3 in a row. They're just going to reel them off without even thinking about it.
Like, do you get pleasure from, like, just completely falsifying stories?
Yeah, of course. He has been preening since this morning, like the cat that got the cream. The Kerry fans are happy.
Why would you preen over the idea of going to a league final against Dublin and getting beaten? Because that's what's going to happen here.
It's the
most inevitable thing.
What was the point of beating them the last time? You're going to go this time and not show anything. It'll be like all of those kids have experience of winning Croke Park all the time. A little bit of a setback in the middle of the summer.
Here's a statistic for you.
Then you roll on to the actual time when they come and they meet them, and it's all about Kerry.
It's not just about those young players, it's about Peter Keane as well. 22 games in the trot he's won as a Kerry manager from minor into senior.
That's not bad, is it?
It's a pretty good stat. It's weird. Like, okay, so Dublin came back really late. They've kind of sleepwalked into the National League. They're still going to make the league final, and they're probably going to win it.
Well, we'll see.
Let's get real here.
They might not win it.
Let's just face up to the reality here that Dublin are going to win the National League.
Kerry,
they're probably going to win the All-Ireland.
But Kerry are clearly a team who will benefit from the quality of the surface in Croke Park and the speed of the surface, and it plays bigger. Like, they're not granted they want the defence to be tight, but they've got pace breaking and they've got ball players who can ping passes, right?
Yeah, and like the thing is, whatever happens in that league final, like, I know we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but let's face it, it is going to be Dublin against Kerry in the final. Whatever happens there, there will still be five or six of their starters yet to come back after that as well.
Yeah. Not a bad situation to find.
No, it's a great situation to be in, but is it a good enough situation to win the All-Ireland this year? I don't think anybody's in a good enough situation to take Dublin off their perch this year.
Yeah, but I'm starting to believe that people are talking about the five in a row enough in March for it to be something that's going to seep into the collective psyche.
The only reason people are going to stop talking about the five in a row is that it becomes such an inevitability. That's the only thing that'll stop to talk about the five in a row. I think we've already got to that point where you may as well give them Sam now. Let's start previewing next year. Can Kerry stop the six in a row?
No, maybe. I think they will stop the
seven in a row, but Dublin will win the next two All-Irelands.
Well, okay, you just yarrowed away 2 years of our lives there, Ron. Thanks very much for that. I mean, a lot's going to happen in our lives in the meantime. Let's move on. Here's Clonduff's Orla Morgan. This is a brilliant interview, speaking with Off the Ball's Aisling O'Reilly. So Clonduff of Down claimed All-Ireland success in the very first ever All-Ireland Intermediate Camogie Club Championship. 10-9 they won. They beat Galtier of Waterford on a scoreline. And here's Aisling asking Orla how come she wasn't playing.
Orla, you've just won the Intermediate All-Ireland Camogie Final. How does it feel?
Okay, it's absolutely amazing. I have to say, it's the best feeling in the world to have winning anything with these girls is just so good. Like, they were just such a tight-knit bunch, and it's just absolutely amazing to have your friends from you were a young age just winning this together. It just means so much. It really does.
And what does it mean for Clonduff as a parish? There's about, 1,600 or maybe not even people in the parish. What does it mean to all of them?
It just means absolutely everything. We're the first team from Clonduff to ever have a play in a match in Croke Park, never mind a final. Mm-hmm. So, the support that has come down today has been absolutely unreal. You know, I don't think there's a person left in Hilltown or Calvary today. It really does mean so much. You know, the messages that have come through all week, and I'm sure they'll continue coming tonight, congratulations and all, but the community and the people of the village have been so good, you know, and the support towards everything has been second to none, you know.
And you're one of the long-serving players from Clonduff, and today, unfortunately, you weren't out there playing. You played up until the Ulster final, and then the All-Ireland semi-final, you weren't featured. And why was that?
Well, I fell pregnant. So thank you. So yes, so that happened. So yes, I had mixed emotions, obviously, you know, going out there today. But it's, you know, obviously there's a good thing that's going to come out of this too. You know what I mean? I'll be a wee Clonduffian, yeah. Clonduffy in one way or another, and they can say they've done a warm up in Croke Park. So, but yeah,
brilliant. And will the celebrations now be back to the club or Hilltown Hotel?
Yeah, back to our club rooms actually. We're back down there this evening. I would say it'll take us a while getting home before, by the time we do a few laps of the square on the back of a lorry, I'm sure. And then down to the club rooms. I know it's a packed out, sold out for the night, regardless of what the result was. People wanted to be there for us. And I would say they'll continue into the very early hours of tomorrow morning and probably to Thursday or Friday even.
Brilliant, Orla. Well, thank you so much and congrats.
Thank you, Aisling. Thank you.
Yeah, so great stuff from the weekend in Croker at the Camogie Finals. We'll play some of the stuff from Slot Neil's victory as well. Alan Quillen is here this morning to talk to us about rugby. It is obviously a Six Nations week, and so we'll talk about France and all the rest of the stuff and the Ireland team. But Alan, you want to start this morning by talking about the Pro 14, right? Because it was one of those quiet weekends of the Pro 14 that everybody doesn't really...
It's on the radar a little bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, but then when you think back all those years ago, it was these weekends that apparently cost Matt O'Connor his job, because he couldn't win when his frontline stars were away. Complained a little bit about not having his frontline stars, and then lo and behold, his time at Leinster was done. In retrospect, it was a good call. It was the right call to bring Leo through, but you've got to win these games.
You have, yeah, and to be fair, Leinster on Friday night, it's a few days. It wasn't probably their most clinical and best performance, winning 19-7 against the Cheetahs, but you got to commend them. They're 22 points clear at the top of Conference A, and can't be caught. They're qualified home semi-final, and that's incredible. The distance between them and everyone else is just phenomenal, and... yeah, the Cheetahs prop should have been sent off the other night for a tackle on Fergus McFadden. He chipped the ball over, and their loose head prop followed through, and Nigel Owens was refereeing. It probably could have been a red, but as I said, it wasn't Leinster's best performance. But with four games left, to be already qualified for a semi-final is phenomenal, to be fair to them.
That's Munster traipsing off.
Yeah, and those pictures kind of sum up the... Probably the performance, maybe the result. It's difficult. The conditions were horrendous. It's quite tricky playing over in Scarlets. It was a game Munster should have won, I thought, and I think they probably think everyone, maybe not the Scarlets fans, but it was the result that they got. They won 10-6 against Munster. Was the result that they got was on the back of an incredibly strong defensive effort, and they deserve a lot of credit for that. And sometimes those kind of wins, you can get a lot out of them because you show a lot of character and stuff. But Munster, they had opportunities. They had 70% possession. They were pummeling the Scarlets line on a number of occasions in the first half and the second half. And they just kind of, at the kind of end result, was a knock-on or a turnover and or a good defensive set from Scarlets. But they had a couple of opportunities. Mike Haley made a line break at one stage and just from a good backline move, and should have passed, and it was a try. Aaron Obota lost the ball as he was going for the line in the second half. Jean Klein's try was ruled out by the TMO. And so the picture summed it up, really. Frustration. It was a big... Maybe it won't be as big in a couple of weeks because Glasgow have to go to Leinster, come to the RDS, and they will be relying... Munster will be hoping that...
Leinster do them a favour.
Leinster do them a favour. And there's four games left. Munster have got to win their four games. But this was a real chance to stay ahead. And it would have been... I thought if they won this one, it would have been the one that would have guaranteed them top spot in the conference. But it makes it tricky for them now. And it was a disappointing loss. And again, it kind of reminded me of that Cass performance over in France, in Europe, where... They had control of the game and just made a lot of mistakes and errors. Now, it is very difficult in wet, mucky conditions, and the Scarlets are, you know, they're competitive. They're getting stuck into Munster. They're trying to, you know, putting their bodies on the line, and in fairness, some credit to that. A few decisions went against them, and that try from Klein in the second half. I thought if they'd scored a try and got ahead, they would have been able to see the game out. But it could be a significant one financially for them, because if they finish second, obviously they'll have a home quarter final, possibly, and then they're away in the semi final, which is again a financial hit for them and a chance. I think if Munster have a home semi final, you would kind of think that they'll win it.
Yeah.
They'll get into a final.
Yeah.
And but unfortunately, I think that loss could come back to bite him. Now it might. Leinster might do him a favour in a few weeks, and we could have that dream Leinster Munster final maybe in Scotland.
The big news from Munster's perspective over the last couple of weeks has been Carberry's injury, and that's going to be the talking point going into the next round of the Heineken Champions Cup. Is there anybody else who's emerged? Is there any positional switches you suspect from the last round of the pool stages to the knockout stages in the Champions Cup?
Well, look, if Carberry doesn't play, it'll probably be JJ Hanrahan, I'd say. Or, you know, Tyler Blaindell has taken a little bit of time to come back, and he's been Hasn't played a huge amount of games. He's been involved off the bench, and I think he had a really horrendous time with injuries. He still looks a little bit nervy and a little bit unsettled in himself in some of his decisions. 2 years ago, I think, I thought this guy is, you know, his acceleration was that way. And so would it be Blaindell or JJ Hanrahan? JJ Hanrahan's only back from an injury himself. So I think everyone will be hoping that, you know, Carberry, given where he's at and the way he's performed for Munster this year, would be fit.
Can Blaindell get back on that trajectory?
Well, he's enough of talent and ability. I think it's probably upstairs how he gets back into the tempo of the game and manages a game well. I think some of the decisions he's probably made since he's come back have been a bit panicky. He's kicked the ball away a few times. And I genuinely, 2 years ago, I remember this guy taking the ball to the line with great confidence and bringing guys inside and outside. He has that footballing ability, but I just think maybe because of being out of the game for so long that he's trying to take an easier option, which is kicking, which probably is not his natural game. You know, he's a running fly half. But look, that's a couple of weeks away. I think all the provinces will be hoping that once the Six Nations block finishes that their top stars are ready and waiting for him and playing. I think the more games Chris Farrell gets, the more games Conor Murray gets will be a boost for Munster, because, you know, they've been undercooked with performances and probably, you know, game time given the injuries they've had in the last 12 months. But yeah, it'll be an interesting couple of weeks. I think everybody in Munster will be hoping, well, Johan van Graan will be probably hoping that Carberry comes through, and hopefully he's involved against France this week. Joe Schmidt said last week that he hopes he'll train.
It must be tough for Blaindell when you come back from an injury like that to actually have that confidence to play the way you play. I think sometimes as a forward it might almost be easier, as weird as that sounds, because you have to engage in the scrum. You almost have to get that.
As a forward, you're kind of trudging straight into the contact. You can't really... There's kind of no real moments that you're standoffish, because your scrum, line out, breakdown, you're going to be tested defensively. That doesn't mean it's easy to get back into the full contact. But I think, you know, I thought it was really interesting what Joe Schmidt said about his number 9 and 10, Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton, that 9s and 10s in rugby, everything goes through them. So they're constantly having to think, make decisions. For forwards, it's a little bit different. You know, you just get a ball, head down, try and plough over someone or carry the ball. You're not really thinking of the bigger picture of tactically where the ball should go and how to direct the team. So it can be tricky. And for Tyler Blaindell, he's a really, really talented player. And, you know, he signed a new contract. So there's obviously...
It's a long-term project to get him back to where he was.
And look, you know, people would say over the last couple of years that... You know, he hasn't been the best investment because of the injuries, and it was kind of, which is very unfortunate for the guy, but I think he has the ability, but he just needs to, you want to see him get that little bit of swagger and confidence back, where he does attack the line like he had been doing up to 2 years ago.
He's still pretty young, like, we're not talking about a 35-year-old here.
26 or 27, I think.
Yeah, so loads of time for an out half to emerge.
But I think that is the concern, though, because of what Carberry's brought this year and a real composure and control. Munster's biggest issue in the last couple of years is not, and this is not to knock the players who've been there, Keatley, Blaindell, JJ Hanrahan, it's just they've been chopping and changing so much. One fly half plays well for 3 games, then he has 2 bad games, and then someone else comes in, and there's an expectation, there's been a fair bit of chopping and changing. So I think what Carberry brings is obviously he's an international who's a very talented guy who's full of confidence and belief, and he's given a real stability in that position this year.
Yeah. You were writing at the weekend in the Indo in your column about the Leinster players ending up all around the places, obviously on the back of the news last week that perhaps Ulster are going to be the next team to benefit again from a member of the Leinster pack heading north. Ultimately, is this something that we need to be cautious about? Like, one of the benefits of Irish rugby is that players play for their team. Yeah. And it's the team that they grew up supporting. And if we just want to be the same as every other country where rugby has no connection and no pathway, really, for local players to be on the local team, fair enough, right? But let's say that's what we're doing. And let's not pretend that we're somehow morally superior to the other countries.
Yeah, the landscape has changed there in from my time playing, and where it's, it was very partisan, and like, would you play with a Munster fella, play with, I know Stephen Keogh and Trevor Hogan did, they were maybe down the pecking order and frustrated that they weren't getting opportunities in a, an incredibly strong Munster squad back then. There was so many, so much depth in the squad.
And everybody played every game. There was no sense of...
Rotation thing didn't sit well with anyone. If you weren't playing, you were seen to be dropped, and you were frustrated and angry. It did start to happen a little bit that, you know, if you're an international, you accepted it more that, look, I'm not playing this weekend, and, you know, you're getting rested, it's more management. But Connacht were probably the first province that bought into this scenario for obvious reasons, because they lacked, they needed a little bit more help and support, and they tended to pick up guys from Leinster and Munster, and mainly Leinster guys who weren't getting into Leinster setup, that it was kind of seen as a feeder province. I don't mean to be disrespectful to them, but that's, it was seen as, that's what it was. And a lot of guys went there, and look at Sean Cronin. He goes to Connacht, and he left Munster, went to Connacht, and then on to Leinster, and he goes on, and, you know, he's had an incredible career. Owen Redden went to Wasps, and that, you know, Connacht have kind of benefited for that. Connacht are in a place now where they're producing their own players, their academy is really good. And you watch the result of the weekend against the Ospreys. They were fantastic. The rugby they're playing is brilliant. And contrast to 12 months ago when, you know, the effect Andy Friend has made. But the rugby they're playing. But going back to the point of this movement around the provinces, I've thought long and hard about this. And the diehard provincial fans will be uneasy about it. And, you know, Munster have a fair few people from outside the province playing. I never particularly had any problem with anybody coming, putting on the red jersey, as long as they bought into the culture, and that they put their body on the line and they showed passion and pride for the jersey. And I kind of haven't changed my mind on that. I think it's really tough on Leinster, who are producing these players, and they probably have the most depth, to lose. I think the biggest blow for them, and, you know, whether they'll say it or not, is Joey Carberry. Because you have a 22-year-old fly half international who's played 9 or 10 internationals, incredible talent. Your number one choice is a 33-year-old World Player of the Year. But
yeah.
He's, you know, ultimately he's not going to be around forever. And here's your natural, unbelievably talented guy who's an international at this age that we're going to have for the next 10, 12 years. And that's not taking anything away from Ross Byrne, who's an excellent player as well. Losing him was probably the hammer blow.
And what if when Sexton retires, that Carberry goes back to Leinster?
But what if Leinster have taken this personally, and they're like, "All right, you go down to Munster. We don't want you back. Ross Byrne is our next 10."
I don't think anyway. You'd be silly to do something like that. I think we're going to see a bit more movement where guys do come and go a little bit. That's what something we haven't seen.
Yeah.
A controversial one like that where someone moves back. Like Keane Keller is moving back to Leinster this year from Connacht. But that's seen as he went there for two or three seasons and actually played really well.
Yeah.
And he wants to go home, and Leinster have signed him back, and he's a really good player.
But
this one is a bit different,
yeah,
you know.
And so what if that happens?
Well, if it happens, it's ultimately down to the
player. That's a kick in the nuts for Munster.
Yeah. And ultimately, the important thing to clarify here is, Ger, the players make these decisions. Now, they can be told...
Heavily influenced, though.
Yeah, they can be influenced, and they can be given, you know, an opinion of, look, if you...
/warning.
Well, it depends what way you want to take it, but ultimately, if there's six back rows in Munster and they're all internationals, like there was in my time, I don't think we'd be allowed to do that now.
Yeah, so...
One of us or two of us would be told, lads, you got to go, look, there's six into three doesn't go here, and there's a couple of more. Like, there's probably three or four more guys in Munster at the time who were stopping up, rightly or wrongly. And so I think there will be a bit more movement.
If you've been told, if you want to play for Ireland, you have to play for Leinster.
Well, I'd have to seriously consider it. And I genuinely felt, well, if you've a closed mentality of saying, well, I'm just Munster and I'm not doing that.
It wasn't part of the power of your Munster team.
If you're on the team, I think... See, there was so very little between some of our players at times there that...
Who was your main...
At one stage, Wally came back from the British and Irish Lions in 2001, David Wallace, and he was playing with Gary Owen when he started that season. Well, the back row was Dennis Leamy, Axel, and myself, and Jim Williams was there as well. So Jim and I were rotating on the bench, or Leamy, or between the four of us. Wally was playing with Gary Owen. James Collin was there as well, and David Corkery was there before that. He'd retired from injury, but it probably wouldn't happen now. But you look at Jack McGrath, if he moves to Ulster, that's Joe Schmidt or anyone in the IRFU can only give advice and say, look, I think it's better if you're playing week in, week out. He cannot say to Jack McGrath, you're not going to be starting for Leinster next year, because Keane Healy is there and Ed Byrne maybe might be challenging you now for number two. How can he do that? He can't do that, and I don't think it'd be crazy to think he would.
I think in that instance it's different when you have somebody like Carberry who they needed to evolve.
But ultimately I think Jack McGrath would probably instigate this himself and look at this in himself.
That's what Roy O'Connor's piece, that was the detail.
And I think that's brave of the player, and I think it's right of the player to think, because if I'm down in Munster and I'm sixth choice back row and I want to play for Ireland, well, you know, you've got to take off the goggles then and say, hold on a minute here, I want to go and play, and it's not exactly a perfect scenario for me, and I'm not a Leinster man, but, you know, I go there and I do what's best for the team, and I'm professional about it, and then suddenly you kind of, you become that person, like Sean Cronin. Sean Cronin's from Limerick, Owen Redden's from Limerick, but did you ever see them kind of slacking off when they played Munster? Not in the slightest, you know. So players have to change their mentality. If Jack McGrath goes up to Ulster, you think you'd have Keane Healy, Dave Kilcoyne, James Cronin, who has had a terrible run with injuries, Dennis Buckley, and Jack McGrath, Eric O'Sullivan for Ulster. It's good for the national team. The national team funds everything. So here, I don't think it's not about money. I think it's about, given the age Jack is at, he will probably get that 3-year contract with Ulster. Yeah. Whereas it depends. Will he get it with Leinster next year when he starts negotiating? So it's probably a bit of both.
One last question for you though. Should if this is going to happen, should those players not be asked to move in the academy years when they're 18, 19, as opposed to...
Yeah, it's a very relevant point.
We spend our time developing them in... So I'm just being Leinster here for a minute. We spend our time developing them and then you pick them. You cherry pick the best ones just before they make our first team, and then we go through the process again, and then you cherry pick those, and it's like, well, get your shit together yourselves. You sort your own academies out here.
I think that's something that's definitely been spoken about in the last few years about the academies in Munster, Ulster, Connacht, and, you know, it is...
Like a draft system for an academy at 18 after the Schools Cup finals.
Sometimes it's
hard.
But then if you have a star player on the schools team, you're trying to not lose him, and he's going through into the sub academy, the academy, and stepping up to development contract. It's a tricky one, and if you start prodding at the younger players, then are you kind of tapping up guys and stuff like that?
But that's the bit that could be completely defined by the IRFU. We have an intake of 50 players to the academy every year. You're getting 15, you're getting 15, you're getting 15, you're getting 15, and we're going to manage and run the academies and invest in them equally.
I understand the broader picture there, but I think it's difficult for 17, 18, 19 year olds who want to play for Leinster, want to play for Munster or whatever, and they're in that academy. They want to see for a year or two where they're at, really. And I think it'd be hard if you started plucking them straight out of school and go pushing them around the place. Plus, they're only kids, really, you know what I mean? And you know, they're starting out. So in concept, the idea is not a bad one, and it's relevant. But I think we're going to see a bit more player migration. It's always happened, but not with the high-profile internationals.
Yeah,
it's happened with guys
more.
Like Niall Ronan came down to Munster. He wasn't playing enough with Leinster. Andrew Conway. And they were brilliant Munster players. Andrew Conway still is, but Niall Ronan became a Munster man. And that happens, like Redden and Sean Cronin, and you know it's probably something we're going to see a little bit more of now with the internationals.
Yeah, no, totally. And you've got to be open to it because it's obviously for the good of the individuals' careers as well. Very quickly, how are you feeling about France 6 days out? What's going to happen?
I think I did the France Scotland game in Paris for Virgin and the last time, and you get a sense of the desperation that was there before that game for the French after what happened in Twickenham against England.
Looked like they found their team, though.
Yeah, well, DuPont...
As long as they don't make 15 changes,
yeah,
they might do.
I don't think you will. DuPont and Intermac at fly half and scrum half were brilliant. Ramos, full back. Demba Bamba, tight head, 20-year-old monster. Brilliant footballer as well around the field.
beautiful little kick from Bastrow in the middle. Hadn't seen that before.
Yeah, and I just think the cream and the crop for that back line would be Fofana in there somewhere, you know what I mean? But they went with Bastrow, and who can be a very skillful player for a big man as well. So they'll have a lot more confidence coming to Dublin, but ultimately it's down to, you know, if Ireland can be more clinical and improve on some of the mistakes and stuff that went wrong. But it'll be physical. France are a big, strong pack, and they, you know, I think Ireland need to start well next Sunday. Yeah. I need to start well, and that kind of stems from a good training week as well. And they probably have to block out some of all the advice that we're all sharing. Going drinking, comparisons with 07, players losing confidence and stuff like that. They're too big to be losing confidence. I think it's just they're in a bit of a frustrating kind of a rut. And I've said this, my opinion, they've played three teams who tried to figure out how they stop Ireland, rather how they play against Ireland firstly, and that's kind of rocked Ireland a little bit. So I think they'll be better. I'd be very surprised if Ireland weren't more clinical and better and have a good plan for France on Saturday, on Sunday. And ultimately, this isn't about getting a 20-point win over France. This is about getting a nice, crisp win and making sure that you get a third win in the championship and you go to Cardiff the week after.
With a chance of being thereabouts. Yeah. All right, Alan, good stuff. Thanks for that. Here's one more from Kenny Cunningham breaking down Gonzalo Higuain's performance yesterday at Fulham.
His two star pupils got goals as well today. You might call them the teacher's pets. Gonzalo Higuain and Jorginho getting his first goal from play since he signed for Chelsea. Probably, though, really important for Higuain to get another goal on the board because, as I said during the commentary, he's only got that brace against Huddersfield. He's been getting chances, but again, it was just a really good striker's effort, wasn't it? Coming in at the near post there to flick that away, and he had a nearly identical chance as well later on in the game, but just important to get that other goal.
Yeah, brilliant centre forward's goal. We saw exactly today the type of service that Higuain needs. A couple of balls early on played over the top, hopeful balls. He just almost gave up the goals. He knows he can outrun 95% centre half, but when he comes alive, he's in around the penalty box, because the devastating pace isn't so much an issue then. It's all about the timing of the runs, and a couple of times he just checked his run, anticipated where the ball was going to be coming, made little darting runs in between defenders, got his goal, which was a great little finish, and almost got a replica in his second goal. But even a couple of balls from Jorginho over the top from slightly different positions, getting off the shoulder of defenders, making it difficult for them to pick him up. Never stands in front of centre half, Stephen, where defenders can see him and the ball. He's always walking off the far shoulders where defenders have to look for him all the time, and when they take their eyes off him, that's his trigger to make those runs in front of defender. So he's a very clever operator, and he'll always score goals, but he is a centre forward who is very much dependent on the service that he's given.
Yeah, it's Kenny, a ringing endorsement of sorts of Gonzalo Higuain. Darren, how are you?
Good morning, Ger. Very well.
A Dublin Kerry All-Ireland final this year?
Not for 2 years, according to Owen. I think he'll set the seven in a row.
It doesn't really matter what the final is. Who would you rather beat in the final? Is there anybody you'd
Mayo.
Really
you want to be Kerry for this.
No, Mayo.
But think about it, five in a row. Think about they couldn't do it, you did it. You did it against them.
The symbolism.
Yeah, come on. Beating Mayo is like, you've already done that a couple of times on the journey to the five in a row. It's your choice here, but I'm just saying, door number one, door number two. Door number two is Kerry.
I'd prefer Mayo, because Mayo have this weird entitlement where they feel like they're owed in all Ireland.
Oh! So I think your mentions have just blown up for the entire day, Darren.
No, they haven't. It's fine. But they in other years, they probably would have had two All-Irelands by now. But they've just come up against probably one of the strongest Dublin teams in history. But they do have an air of entitlement about them. It's not a bad thing.
Put up your Twitter handle helpfully there as well, at Radio Cleary.
Yeah, you need it in sport. You need to have that belief that you're better than everyone else and you always deserve to win.
Backpedaling there, Darren.
No. I think it's fine that they have confidence, maybe a bit of arrogance, a little bit misplaced over the last couple of weeks. But I would prefer Mayo in the final, yeah.
It's a Liverpool situation, isn't it? A lot of people will get pleasure from not seeing Mayo win in All-Ireland.
I'd be one of them, yeah.
That's like a completely understandable point of view. Completely understandable point of view.
You want Mayo to win in All-Ireland?
No, I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. I'm like...
He's egging you on here.
Where are you on it? Do you want Mayo to win?
I want Mayo to win in All-Ireland. I want Liverpool to win
the
league.
They're old in All-Ireland.
I don't think they're old one. I think this group of players has been a great group of players, as good as any of the other great Gaelic football teams they just have this like one thing that they haven't got, and that's an All-Ireland. And when they get that, everybody will go, oh, that was a great Mayo team, wasn't it? We can all openly talk about the fact that it is a team festooned with great players.
I think we can already talk about them like that, no? I think people will look back on the Mayo team of 2017 as a great Mayo team.
I put them in my top five teams of the millennium, and you get shot down immediately. Oh, they won nothing.
It hurts their legacy to not win anything, though. Like,
yeah, of course it does. Because we see winning as the be-all and end-all. And like, we had Joseph O'Brien in the other day, and I was like, so what's the most important, or what's the best part of your job? Winning. I hadn't even got sentence finished. Winning. It's all about winning. It's all about winners. And it's true. Like, ultimately, that's the thing that fans and supporters, whichever group you put yourself in, want more than anything. And Mayo haven't done that.
I think it's a completely fair take to put them in your top five teams at the Millennium.
Yeah, I think it's fine. I think obviously it would mean more to be able to class them as All-Ireland winners, and it would be a diversion from the best team never to win it. I think that's probably the title no one wants to have. But I don't think it removes from the greatness of some of the individuals they have in that team that they've never won an All-Ireland.
I still think they're a great team. Like, I think that all of the stuff that they've done, they have, I think, been the defining characteristic of Dublin's greatness. You came up against a rival that was
nonsense.
That was worthy.
Nonsense. Well, there's a defining characteristic.
There's something
of
in
Dublin.
That own. Like, you need a really strong rival to bring out.
Maybe the team that brought Dublin on an inch. But let's face it here, the real mastermind behind Dublin, if you want to give it to anybody who's not Jim Gavin or somebody in Dublin, is Jim McGuinness. Donegal are the one team that have pushed Dublin on beyond any other. Mayo have been a great rival, but it is nonsense to say that they are the defining characteristic of Dublin. The defining characteristic of Dublin is an unbelievable work ethic and attention to detail, a cold, calculated manager who is ruthless beyond belief, and a set of players that are incredible athletes and brilliant footballers. That is what the defining characteristic of this Dublin team is. So stop giving too much credit to Mayo. Great team. And to be honest with you, I agreed with you a moment ago that they could be a top five team at the Millennium, but it is nonsense to give them any more than even just a sliver of credit for what Dublin have achieved.
I think there's something in the Jim McGuinness line, because he spurred an evolution in Jim Gavin's thinking as a manager, that maybe you can't win all before you with swashbuckling, open, expansive football. That seemed to stun him in the manner in which they lost that All-Ireland semi-final a couple of years ago. And I think that changed more in Dublin football than maybe any of those finals against Mayo did. That was a real sea change. That was when they started looking at the basketball. That was when they started looking at
totally.
The...
Yeah, totally. And that did totally change them. But like, in the minds of the public, like, you have to have a great rival. That makes everybody get drawn to it. Because if they just won last year's All-Ireland, the whole thing from start to finish was so boring. It meant nothing to the outside world beyond the Dublin fans, right? It wasn't boring to you guys. It was sensational. It was like a high watermark for the team. I absolutely get it.
If we're being honest, though, it does lessen. It does diminish. Like, you'd be kidding yourself if you felt the same way about 2011 as you did about 2018. It's very hard to replicate that feeling of the first time it happens, and it's this new experience. It feels like... It just feels magic after years of near misses and getting close and always being hyped. It does lose its shine somewhat.
I think the two big what ifs in GAA in the last decade are, what if Tipperary hadn't lost that Liam Sheedy, Eamon O'Shea dream team management immediately after winning the All-Ireland? I think that would have been an amazing period of hurling for that two greatest teams of their age going against each other with everybody still in their pomp. And what would have happened if Jim McGuinness had stuck around in Donegal and they were able to, because we never saw Dublin and Donegal ever play again after Dublin learned the lessons of that defeat, and that would have been great. But I still think that Mayo team and those games, they'll be the defining games of the...
No, they will.
Well, actually, you've got to take the Donegal game in too, you know?
I think
three games that make the Dublin legend. If you've got to pick three games, what are you picking? Are you picking the first Kerry game in 2011 where Cluxton kicks the winner?
You kind of have to, don't you?
You probably do.
Because of what was obviously the drought, and also the drought against that Kerry team.
It's not a defining moment in their evolution as a great team. I think it's the start of their...
It's the start of Lerwigs, but more important.
Yeah, that would be up
potentially.
There. The Donegal one is so
start of Lerwigs, Donegal, one of the Mayo games?
Like, it depends which Mayo game you pick.
Pick two defeats and a draw?
The Kerry game, the year Fitzmaurice copped the kickouts and Dublin were really struggling.
Yeah.
That could have been a really big moment. Yeah. That was the first time that the kickout plan had been rumbled by anyone. There was just this great vision of Kerry players going around waving their arms. It looked like it was madness, but there was so much there was a method to it, and it made so much sense, and it really put Dublin on the back foot. I had horrible fear that day that we were found out here, we were exposed, we'd been caught, we'd been figured out, and we'd been outpought like we were against Donegal in that semi-final.
I don't think I'm off the adrenaline rush still after. I had to go outside and ask somebody for a cigarette at half time of that game. I was like, I need to calm down in some way. The adrenaline rush at half time.
So give me some nicotine.
Exactly. I was like, I need something to get me off this.
It was crazy.
And I think I'm still on that adrenaline rush, to be quite honest with you. I've never come down off that.
It's one of my favourite games of football in history. What was it, like 5 points in the difference in the end? Like the
closest.
No.
Is it not?
You're talking about 2013. 2016, there was only 2 points of difference. Like, let's.
It felt like it was nothing. Like there was.
Yeah, I think it was a 2 point win in the end. That was obviously when Peter Crowley gets shouldered in the chest and no free is given.
It was a funny substitution as well.
Mark O'Shea got brought on for Paul Gainey.
Yeah, that was an album calling Gainey off.
Gooch dropped the ball into Cluxon's arms. I don't remember much of the details except for all the little instances of pain.
Right. Yeah, most of that's on YouTube, by the way. Go on.
Ireland's latest medal winners are celebrating this morning. Ciara Mageean and Mark English won bronze for Ireland at the European Indoor Athletics Championships yesterday. The Letterkenny man secured a third place finish in the 800 metres. The 26-year-old Mageean claimed her first indoor medal in the 1500 metres final. The Port of Ferry woman is happy to take home the tin, but admits she was disappointed to be beaten on the line.
Very, very difficult game for different reasons.
That's Jurgen Klopp. That is not Ciara Mageean. It's two disappointed people, though.
Do we have Keir? We have no Keir. We'll come back to Keir. Liverpool are cursing their luck after a fourth draw in six games saw them relinquish the lead to Manchester City. The Reds were 7 points clear when the sides met in January, but now City are just a point behind their City's Liverpool's path over the last couple of weeks. Not really the bottle job that some people would suggest statistically, because they've been top for almost all of it, bar one or two little blips. And those greys are, of course, the draws over the last few weeks.
Did you just describe a bottle job there?
2016 was 2 points in the end.
2 points, yeah.
I should never doubt it,
John. The Reds were 7 points clear with the sides met in January. Liverpool's 0-0 draw at Merseyside rivals Everton has cost them ground in the title race. Manager Jurgen Klopp, though, says it's rubbish to suggest Manchester City have overhauled their lead because he's too cautious.
Sorry, don't understand that question. So we have seven draws and they lost more games. And what does that have to do with the standard?
What, in the sense, do you feel like maybe you have to go to the jugular a little bit more in terms
of... I'm really disappointed about your question. I'm really disappointed. I have to say, just because it was you feeling... It's football that... We don't play PlayStation, eh? Do you think we didn't take enough risks today? Is that what you want to ask? That's a really disappointing question, I have to say, because that means like it's so easy. I tell them, boys, we take more risk. Come on, boys, we go for it. Can you imagine? Is there any draw and we didn't try to win? What is that?
An extra attacker in this?
Just to go wild. 9 match days, obviously. I say a lot of reasons why in Liverpool you are all not experiencing, obviously, fighting well. You think it's, again, PlayStation, bring an extra attacker and football change. That's not like that. We are offensive enough. Football doesn't work like that. Come on.
Football doesn't work like that.
I agree.
Well, didn't Kevin Kilbane say earlier on he wished he saw different substitutions from Jurgen Klopp? Is that PlayStation analysis from Kevin Kilbane, I wonder? Like, I think it's a fair comment to actually ask the question, should you have made different substitutions?
It is, yeah, but I'd say most of the questions are completely fair. What Klopp doesn't like at the moment is the inference that somehow it's his responsibility. And like, it's immediately aftermath of a game where you think you've just blown your opportunity to win the league, you're going to be pissed off. We all need to calm down at how pissed off managers get. They're going to get pissed off, their leg get pissed off, right?
And we're allowed to get pissed off with them getting pissed off.
They might say some stupid stuff, but we're not really, because we just know he's pissed off.
You can be pissed off if you want, it doesn't matter.
He was right to be pissed off at the ball boy. The ball boy was acting the arse.
Yeah, I mean, I thought so. But then, like, was he just clapping or did he have a bake on him?
It was very sarcastic.
Was that it, or was it just...
But he kept doing it, even when Klopp walked up to him and was like, what are you doing?
Well, I'm clapping you off because, you know, it's what we're supposed to do. We're a classy club here.
Yeah.
I love the way Everton are just like so happy in their self-loathing place to say, you'll win nothing this year, knowing well that Liverpool fans are like, what? You're saying this to us? And they're just like, yeah, we're fine with where we're at.
We'd rather you lose something than us win anything.
Yeah, precisely.
That's what real rivalry is. Chelsea have kept up the pace with the Champions League spots after beating Fulham 2-1. It wasn't a happy return to the Premier League for Brendan Rodgers. Celtic fans are delighted after his Leicester side were beaten 2-1 by Watford. Shamrock Rovers look to get back to winning ways in the SSE Air Tristy League later. The Hoops drew with Dundalk last Friday night. That followed a derby defeat to Bowes at Dalymount tonight. They face a Finn Harps side still without a win. Ollie Horgan's men, though, have been very strong defensively. They've only conceded 4 goals in 4 games and picked up points against Pats and Dundalk. Kickoff at the Tallaght Stadium tonight is at 8 o'clock. Well, Dublin boosted their hopes of securing a spot in the Allianz League final. The All-Ireland champions defeated Roscommon by 214 to 112 at Dr. Hyde Park yesterday. Kerry remain in control at the top of Division 1 of the Allianz Football League. The Kingdom beat struggling Monaghan by 17 points to 13 in Killarney with a 100% record from their opening 5. Kerry odds on to contest the final when it rolls around on March 31st. A point from either of their last 2 games against Mayo, that's at home, and Roscommon on the road will guarantee that spot. With superior points difference, wins in both of their remaining games against Tyrone and Cavan should see the Dubs reach yet another league final. The weather played havoc with the Allianz Hurling League yesterday. The games between Cork and Tip and Wexford and Kilkenny both called off due to waterlogged pitches. It means Clare will have to wait to find out if their draw with Limerick is enough to send them into the quarterfinals of the competition. In Division 1B, the game between Galway and Waterford also postponed. Dublin, though, moved to the top of the table as a result following a narrow win over Laois. Despite the loss, Laois secured their place in the quarterfinal over Offaly after Offaly defeated Carlow and Netwatch Cullen Park. Nigel Dunn has confirmed his departure from the Offaly football panel. The star forward has sensationally quit after claiming he felt isolated and unwelcome in the setup. His decision to walk away comes amid reports of a fallout with the manager, John Mahon. Dunn played in Offaly's first win of their Division 3 league campaign at Carlow last month. The 29-year-old scored the levelling point then against Longford, but has not been seen since. John Mahon says he was shocked and surprised to get a text from Dunn informing him of his decision. Here's what Dunn posted on Twitter today regarding the departure from the panel. He says, "Everyone can now move on." And then he says, "The manager was aware of personal issues going on in my life. The text I sent saying I was leaving the panel was a result of weeks of an uncomfortable environment for me personally. I felt isolated and unwelcome in the setup. I appreciate my reputation goes before me, but this is a different scenario. Now that is that. It's best for all involved. Best of luck to the players and the management for the remainder of the year." Big news coming out of Offaly there. Well, Sleacht Neill of Derry claimed their third consecutive All-Ireland Club Camogie title. They beat St Mirren's of Wexford 1-9-7 in Croke Park yesterday. It was a double for Ulster sides as Clonduff of Down beat Waterford's Galtier to claim the intermediate crown. Galtier keeper Kira Jackman improvised to stay warm in the cold conditions. She brought her hot water bottle to Croke Park, something we've all been tempted to do high up in the Hogan Stand or in the hill on cold nights. Well, the World Rugby Chairman Bill Beaumont has called a meeting in Dublin to discuss plans for the World League and the future of international rugby. All Tier 1 countries, along with Fiji, Japan and the Players Union, will attend. It's after Owen Farrell and Johnny Sexton led a revolt against the current plans. Describing them as out of touch, they warned of serious player welfare and integrity concerns about the vision for the tournament currently being shopped to stakeholders. Bowman said in a statement, "Contrary to reports, no decisions have been made. There is an ongoing and complex process with multiple stakeholders, some with differing views. Only by working together in the interests of the global game can we achieve something truly impactful in this important area for rugby's future global growth."
Darren, good stuff. Thanks very much for that. Reminder that we'll be back on air tomorrow morning at 7.45 when we're live on News Talk and across offtheball.com and all our social channels from 7 o'clock this evening. Monday Night Rugby, a look back at all the weekend sporting action, including Pat Nevin's thoughts on the weekend's football. You can watch all the stuff on offtheball.com. You can subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a good place to get all of our stuff as well. It's just youtube.com/offtheball. To play us out today, though, another brilliant piece from the Camogie. Here is the Sleacht Neill manager, Damian McIlderney, talking with Aisling after about his own hectic build-up to yesterday's final. And remember, you can get all these videos on our social channels. Good luck.
And will the celebrations go on for days now?
Oh, yes. It'll be a couple of days. I might have to rein it on a wee bit. I only had a newborn boy there. So,
oh, God, yes.
I mightn't just get out as much as I plan, but I'll try and push it as much as I can.
Did I hear that the due date could have been today, but it came early?
It was. Originally, the due date was today, but he came just over 2 weeks early. So
oh, brilliant.
He must have been looking out for me.
Yeah.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 a.m.